The famous American stage and film actor-director Frank Hall Crane once said, "What is a friend? I will tell you, it is someone with whom you dare to be yourself." Perhaps my favorite aspect of being a comic book creator are the friendships I've made along the way. This industry is perhaps the most conducive to developing friendships, both meaningful and influential, that will last a lifetime. As much as I enjoy having written a solid script for an artist too talented to be working for me for shared IP and back-end pay, I am truly enamored with the comic book communities in almost every major city in the world that encourage your work to exist. 5 years ago, I was determined to break into an industry I knew absolutely nothing about. It's my local comic book shops like Bourbon Street Comics and Brooklyn Comics and more that have provided insight, support, and guidance when I needed it most. I urge every comic book creator out there to never forget that friends like to help friends out. Going out and making friends with your retailer is an investment in your future as a creator. The truly great shops foster a genuine love for creators both established and emerging, and provide an awareness of the awesomeness that is comic books. Unlike a traditional bookstore, comic book shops provide a camaraderie that is inherent to the experience of reading them. Reading a comic book is a very solitary matter, sure, but the magic of them is that they also possess a communal experience that all of us tap into each Wednesday. This is why we're here, to get published, right? Sure, but I've come to realize that being published should not be an insular event. Celebrating publication in solitude is like self-publishing, but with more crying in the shower as you clutch your 10th rejection letter. I don't know about you, but the moment I know that I've achieved my goal of breaking into comics is the day I walk through the door of my shop and see my book sitting on the shelf. No amount of money or fame will compare to that one defining moment I've envisioned for 1,825 days and counting. If you've ever been listening to this show since its inception, then it's no secret how important my friendship with my two co-hosts, Curtis Weave and Ryan K. Lindsay, have been in my development. Instrumental, really. We can and will talk about the process of writing until the sun goes down, but eventually you have to put down your pen or hit save on that open document, get up off your ass, and go out and say hello to the world. Evening, guys. How are we doing?
Fantastic, man. I feel like we need like the Care Bears theme over that. It just was, it's love, man. I was digging it.
Yeah, it was well done, man. Very well done.
Thanks.
I gotta say that's true about comics. We should be in competition and hating each other. But every time I get an email from you, Jeremy, about something, I'm like, right on, let's push it. I wish I could like push it out there more. Like it's amazing that in this community, everyone is very pro each other.
Yeah, it's really, you know, it's surprising because I was actually talking to Kurt about. You know, some reviews I read recently that were just kind of negative, and it actually shocked me because I realized I haven't read a lot of negative reviews in a while, and yeah. it blindsided me. It wrecked my whole day. I was like, wow, because I'm so used to just being so positive with everyone because everyone else is positive. That's how Image Expo went a month ago. It was positivity all day long. It was just awesome. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you were more upset about that review than I was.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was this guy that just slagged Peter Panzerfaust. Like, he just was cruel. And at first I was like, man, I'm kind of offended. But then it was just so angry that I came all the way around again and I was okay with it. You know, it was all right.
Is that a really sort of short review?
Kind of. It was like he basically...
Though he wasn't reviewing anything technical about it. It was more about just what these types of properties like Peter Panzerfaust represent.
He basically went on, you know, this kind of a rant that basically said that that, you know, me, Nick Spencer, and Robert Kirkman were failed short story writers because we were lazy and this was the best thing we could do with our writing, kind of thing. So he's totally right. I mean, anyway, we won't focus on that. Let's talk about some good things. Great intro, Jeremy. We'll focus on some other things that we enjoyed over the last, I guess it's been almost a month since you've recorded, but we are going on to the wow factor, where we talk about positive things and things that we really like. And I'm bringing the intro on this one, so I will talk about my wow factor, which isn't, interestingly enough, a book. I mean, I was going to talk about We 3 a bit because I finally got around to reading that and it was good, but my wow factor isn't necessarily a comic book. It's more comic retailers. And I had an amazing experience at Baltimore, where I went to Baltimore, Maryland, and I did a signing at Third Eye Comics in Annapolis, Maryland, with Steve and Trish, who run the shop there. And it was amazing. It was such an amazing experience that, you know, I found these guys, these retailers are bringing in, you know, talent to do signings for their people that, you know, support their store. And, you know, they flew me and Tyler out to their store. They covered the cost of our hotel. They covered the cost of our flight and our food, and they were just so nice and super, super supportive. And not only all those awesome things, but they really promoted the hell out of this appearance. I mean, I've done signings where basically there's a, you know, sticker in the window, and it's, you know, you get like 5 or 10 people. And truthfully, I was pretty concerned that that would be the case, you know, like, well, these poor guys put all this effort in and, you know, 10 people show up. But he was every day on Twitter, every day on his website, he was promoting the event. And I was going into it, I was concerned. And then we got a tweet from him on Saturday morning before our signing, which was at 11 in the morning. He tweeted me at 8 and he said, "We've got people lined up already. They've been here since 7. And I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, he's like, you know, we just let our customers know that this is going on and that we build up this environment of excitement and, you know, that you guys have come from Canada to do this for us. And it was just such an amazing experience. And I think I didn't really think it was something that was really possible. And this level of excitement from the retailer, not only was, you know, he building up before the show, but at the show, the guy was just in with his customers, talking with them, you know, even if they weren't lined up to sign, you know, for the signing, he was selling them stuff, talking about books. And I heard him pitch my book 100 times better than I've ever pitched it. And he was like, literally, like, there'd be people who came in just to buy their, you know, their pull list, not knowing what was going on. And he would get them in the line and just say, look, this is what the book's about. This is why you should be reading it. There are retailers out there that are doing this kind of thing. They are excited. They are talking about independent comics in particular. And that level of energy just floored me. And it got me really excited to, you know, reach out to more retailers that are doing this. You know, if you're on Twitter, there's the comic market hashtag where a lot of these retailers are, who are doing this sort of thing, are talking with each other and they're talking with creators and fans. And there's this real great community that is coming out of it. And I'm so impressed. I'm so impressed with what these retailers are willing to do and how excited they are about independent projects and supporting independent creators, that there's a whole environment that we can tap into. And it's very, very exciting times.
Well, they keep saying 2012 is the year of the creator. So it's good to see it
happen.
Well,
it is. And these retailers are the backbone of this. They are the ones that are on the ground level, getting the fans excited, getting them in the door, doing things to create this excitement. And they are definitely Third Eye Comics. You know, thank you for doing that. It was something that really invigorated me and made me feel really proud of the projects that I'm working on and feel like, yeah, people really care about what I'm doing. And it was just an amazing experience. And if, for all those listeners out there, you know, contact these retailers. They want to hear from you. If you're already a creator,
yeah,
and you aren't contacting these people, you're doing yourself a major disservice. Because I got an email after the show and he said, you know, I put so many more people on Peter Panzerfaust now have on their pull list because of your signing. He's like, it's, you know, we have way more than we had before just because you came down. And like, there you go. It's maybe an extra 50 people that are going to be buying my book every month. And if that, you know, kind of thing continues, it just, it's a huge market and it's a huge opportunity.
I mean, those are the places where, I mean, shops like that, you know, foster that thing. I mean, they want people in the shop and it's like an experience, and, you know, it's so much better, I think, from as a, you know, fan of, as a collector, is to go in and like, go in and get my books and go in and talk to the people. And like, and it's like I said in the intro, like you need to invest that time because they're going to be supporting you down the road.
And exactly.
They're the people you want to have on your team. And it's not anything you have to convince them of. You just have to say hello and introduce yourself. I mean, it's really quite easy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, that was my wow factor. Ryan, what was something that knocked your socks off?
And I picked up a new book. It's called The Secret History of D.B. Cooper. It's by Brian Shirilla. It's from Oni. It's a good book. It's a really good book. It's totally something different, and it made me sort of – I remember reading things about D.B. Cooper years ago, but it made me sort of re-delve into that whole conspiracy theory about the guy who robbed a flight and then jumped out of the back stairwell mid-flight.
Right,
was never seen again, and they don't really know who he was or where the money went. And Brian Shirilla is taking this story and – is really just twisting it and warping it and trying something different with it. Complete success. And there was one page in particular where I don't want to spoil too much of the story, I guess, but they're putting someone into sort of like a, I guess, a psychedelic fugue state. And the bottom half of the page is split up into two rows, each with seven panels in them. So there's 14 panels, and they're obviously then very small to fit in. And there's only sort of one a spoken section in those whole 14 panels, and everything else, it's just breaking it down really slowly. You can see he's got an eyedropper, and he's dropping a little ball of liquid out of it, and then it floats through the air, and then it floats above the character's open eyeball. And I just love the fact that really it stopped me. It made me slow down. It made me read the passage. I love that comics and panels can do that. They control your time with how you engage with the story. And just reading through, not a lot happens. Basically, he gets an eyedropper and he drops a little bit of liquid into a guy's eye. But he spreads that out over half a page, and it's just really, really masterful. You can see it's very deliberate, and it's metered, and it's layered. And that for me was something. I like reading a book where I stop and go, I could use a technique like that. I'll put that into my, you know, under my hat, and I'll use it at some stage. It's nice to see a bit of craft on display. So that was my wow factor for this show.
Very nice. I've seen that. I mean, I've been hearing about it, and didn't Ed actually letter that book, Ed Brisson?
Yep.
Yeah, because he was talking a bit about it, and we were having a conversation, and he said it was really good. I just have not had a chance to pick it up yet, so.
It's pretty cool. I'd say definitely delve into it. I'm in on the series now. I'll follow it along for sure.
Excellent.
All right, Jeremy, what do you got for us?
So, I kind of had the idea of I knew what was my wow factor was going to be, but it actually didn't turn out that way. I actually went with Rebel Blood.
Yeah,
because it's funny because. I knew what the story is about. Riley had even sent me a PDF to just look it over because he was just wanted some just feedback or whatever. And even though I've already actually read it, like seeing it in print form and rereading it again, I realized that there was this really interesting pacing to it that it's disorienting, but in a very subtle way with the captions and with multiple characters talking. And it's not so much about, like, you know, zombies, even though it is a zombie story. I wasn't so shocked about that because, you know, we've read so many zombie stories, we've seen so many zombie movies and whatnot, but it was about this guy who's unhinged, and that to me was even creepier because this guy is now existing in a world where things are going horribly wrong and he can't even keep it together for himself. Like, he's seeing things and he's imagining different outcomes to a certain scenario, and it's things I do when I think about, you know, if I was to, you know, escape from a burning building or whatever, but he can't keep it together. Like, and that to me was scary, and I was just really, really impressed by it. I read it and I literally said wow at the end. I was like, even though I knew where the story was going for the first issue, rereading it in print form was a completely different experience for me, and yeah, I was pleasantly surprised.
Those sequences were really cool where it's just sort of – it kept sort of branching off to show what he was very quickly thinking could happen. And I love the one where it ended with the last panel of him sitting in a bar or whatever, and they're like, I can't believe you turned that into a song, man, genius.
Yeah.
So what sort of dick is going to think like that after what he's going through? But it is. It's one of those things that go through somebody's head. It was really cool.
It was cool because, you know, it's a lot of character development really quickly. But it was done well. Like, you know, I felt myself being a little disoriented for a moment and then realizing what was going on and going, ooh.
Yeah.
Oh. So yeah. Really good.
Yeah, I'm really happy for Riley because, you know, that project he has been talking about since last year, and you know, the reviews have been really good for it. And you just, you know, going into a new project, you just never know how the audience is going to take it. Even if you like it or you have friends that like it, you just aren't sure. And I'm just really happy for him, you know, that this book is doing really well and people out there are loving it. So good. Yeah. Congratulations, Riley, man. It's a great book.
Absolutely.
Nice. All right. Well, let's kick off of other people's work and get into our own, lads. We've got the progress report. Let's see what we've been up to. I'll kick us off. The Beginnings anthology that I'd spoken about as fundraising for so long, we finally had the launch night and people turned up and people bought it, and we had artists sketching in it for people on the night. It was really, really cool. It was an awesome night, and we've had it in our local LCS selling, and I believe we're getting it across Australia as well into other shops. And I walked into my store, Impact Comics, the other day, and I saw Beginnings anthology sitting right up next to the register facing out of the crowd. And of course, as I walked past, I was like, oh, wow, is this the Beginnings anthology? That's really good, so I've heard. I don't know if anybody heard me do that. But, yeah, I spoke to one of the chicks behind the counter, and she was like, actually, we're selling through a few of them. They've only got a few left in stock. So it's really cool to walk in the store and see, like, I think it's 9 pages I've got in there available for anybody to peruse or possibly buy. So finally having something printed up and out there, and the book is gorgeous too. It's about 174 pages. It ended up going wickedly big, so it's fantastic value for $30. And it's all gloss paper, great color. It's fantastic to see that come through. So I feel like 2012 has started the way I certainly want to finish it, which is getting published. So that's happened, and I've been kicking along on that Daredevil essay book, and I've pretty much edited all I can. I'm just waiting on a handful of contributors to get me their essays in. One of them actually is the publisher, so I feel like I can't really write his ass too hard because, you know, the buck stops with him anyway. So I'm waiting on about 2 or 3 essays to come through, and then the book will be finished, and I'll send it into their final crack editorial team, and hopefully there's not too much of a turnaround. I'd love to see it get published in time for New York Comic Con, but I don't know what the turnaround time with Sec Art is, so I don't know. I'll see how it goes, but it is going to be a kick-ass book, I got to say. If you're a Daredevil fan at all, this book is going to be the ultimate compendium on it. We've covered such a broad range of topics, and I'm really happy with how it's come together. It's just meant that I've been doing a lot more editing, I've noticed, this year than actual writing, because I've got these pictures sort of ready to go, and my other stuff has just been all editing. I'm already looking at doing a follow-up book with Sec Art. I still need to officially pitch it, but I've been talking with the two publishers, and they've given me, if not a green light, at least an aqua light. So we're getting there. So it's good to know I'll have a bit of a home to get some more words out. And I got a call up for one of their other books to write an essay. I guess I shouldn't say what topic on, because that would spoil the announcement later on for them. But I wrote a nice little 5,000-word essay for them, which I'm just going to let sort of sit for a good week, and then I'm going to come back to it and proof my own stuff. I find anything that I write, you can't proof it that day or the next day. I need to have a bit of distance and time. So yeah, the nonfiction stuff's been going well. And a really big coup, which I'm actually really excited to talk about, is there's another sort of small publisher that does novels. It's called Martian Lit. And it looks like I'll have a novel picked up by them at the moment.
Really?
So, nice.
Yeah. I've been liaising with them, and I sent in the synopsis and the chapters. And the guy I sent it to was like, this is awesome, I love it, let me send it to, you know, the conference roundtable. And the feedback I got was unanimous. They loved it, which was really cool, because I always assumed there's always one dick in the room that'd be like, Ryan's an ass, we don't want him. But it didn't happen this time. So, yeah, it's the novel You Must Remember This, which is the guy's life on the internet. And so the next real step is I need to go through the whole novel, and I want to do one last sort of edit pass on it, just to make sure it's really tight, and then I'll send it in. And I don't know, I mean, Kurt, you just had a novel published, and it had sat by the wayside a little while for you, much as my novel had. Yeah. How did you find time-wise going through editing it? Was it a bit of a killer?
It wasn't actually too bad. I was lucky. A lot of the edits were fairly simple. Like, it wasn't like I had to go back and rewrite like an entire chapter or anything like that. Most of them were just like, she would go through and actually make the changes for me, like just like grammatical or things like that. So she would make them, then she'd make notes stating like, this is what I changed. Do you okay this change? The only thing I really had to do was flesh out basically the last page of the book. And that took me, you know, maybe a few days. But yeah, it was actually relatively painless.
Yeah, so I haven't submitted the whole thing to them yet. I want to give it that pass before. I guess I'm a neurotic writer. I want to make sure it's all good, and I want to read it one more time. So hopefully that won't take me too long. And yeah, I could. And they're really keen on like doing digital publishing. And I don't know, I'm really loving that at the moment, the idea of, you know, novels on iPads and Kindles and stuff like that. So I really want to go forward with this project. So everything seems really good on that end. The pitch for my book Heist, the heist on the Cryptozoological Zoo, it's looking promising with a publisher at the moment. They've asked for a full script for the first issue. And thank God I'd already written it. Because they sort of said, oh, just send it through. And I was like, oh, man, if you'd asked that for any other pitch, I would have been like, yeah, all right, I'll see you in a month. But this one had sat and I'd polished it. And I had a read through it. And it's going to sound so idiotic, but I loved it. I was reading through the script and going, this has got to be picked up. This is, oh, Ryan, you're a genius. Good work, old chap. So fingers crossed they think the same. But again, I am my own biggest fan. But yeah, it's looking really good. The guy I've been liaising with is like, I love it. Most of the round table love it. I didn't get the unanimous feedback this time, but the quibbles seem to be minor. So I'm hoping and knocking on wood at the same time that that will be going forward. And with the same publisher, I actually contacted them, and this was something I guess you don't always have the opportunity to, but I've discovered it's a really good idea. I contacted the publisher and said, what sort of stuff are you looking for? And they said, oh, we're looking for, you know, crime and sci-fi and Western. And that automatically just sort of got me into a bit of focus. All right, I'm not going to pitch my superhero one to you. And I'm not going to pitch, you know, something that's – I won't necessarily pitch something that's outside that wheelhouse. And so started sort of looking toward some other ideas. And they said that I can pitch without art, which is so awesome, I've got to say. And so I pitched a sci-fi idea, and it's one I'd been sitting on actually for a little while. It had just been percolating, and when they said they're looking for sci-fi, I was like, I know what I can do. And then Saga dropped, and there's mild similarities of sort of tone, I guess. And so the publisher's getting a little bit of cold feet because apparently I'm so good, I'm exactly like Brian K. Vaughan. That's what I took from that's all I heard. So
I was just saying, were you pitching that just straight up script, or did you have art for that already?
No, it was just a plot synopsis and issue breakdowns. Nice. So yeah, it wasn't like I put months of my life into it, but I put in enough that I felt it was really tight, and I ran it past some people. So yeah, unfortunately, it just seems like it's about two lovers from different bloody intergalactic species that are sort of on the run, and yeah, I guess. It's not the same as Saga, and I'd been sitting on it for a while, so shame on me. I should have really rolled this ball earlier. But it looks like it's not going to get picked up. But then the publisher just recently got back to me and said, look, we've got a concept that we're relatively keen on going forward on. It looks like it'll be maybe a bit of an ongoing. Would you be interested in writing it?
Nice.
So yeah, so I was like, well, you got to sell it to me, baby. I want to be, you know, intrigued. No, of course not. I said, yeah, giddy up. So, it looks like we're still sort of getting balls in motion. It still needs to be greenlit, but considering it's coming from in-house and it's a pretty kick-ass idea as well, I'm pretty keen on it. And I've already been emailing back and forth with the prospective artist, with the guy who brought it to me, and then the head honcho publisher, and we've been roundtabling in an email. And I've been putting forward my 2 cents on character and theme and everything like that. So fingers crossed, it should get across the line, and then I could have a bit of a writing job there. So I'll definitely keep you guys keyed up as it comes along, though.
Awesome.
And that's great, man. That's been about my progress for the last month, guys.
Well done, sir.
Thank you very much. Kurt, what do you got?
Well, it's been kind of I'm really learning a lot about balancing my schedule and traveling. And I mean, 2012 is a crazy year for me as far as appearances and cons and all that kind of stuff. I don't know if I've talked about this on the show before, but I'm basically gone back in, around Valentine's Day. From that point, I basically have been traveling every 2 weeks, and that continues on until the end of June. So it's been interesting. I like it, but I also have to, you know, I find myself, I'm on the plane and then I'm thinking, oh man, like I haven't done any paid work for like a week. And it's a bit scary. You know, I'm starting to, trying to learn how to balance this traveling with getting a lot of work done. So some of the cool things that have happened for me recently are, I've been getting that video game that I wrote last year called Super Motherload. They are basically wrapping up. They're into their final edits for getting the game done. It's a WiiWare game. It's also going to be available for the iOS. So like if you have an iPad, it'll be out for that. And basically they came back to me. I wrote up the complete story. I wrote all the characters. I wrote the storyline. And then they came back to me last month and said, look, we want to do some final revisions on the story. We're not quite, you know, we want to change the ending a little bit. And it wasn't a little bit they wanted to change. It was pretty significant. So I ended up having, you know, putting a bit of time into that, rewriting the final sequence of the game, and really it became a lot bigger project. So that's good. I mean, I needed some paid work at the time, and it's pretty fun work. You can't really complain about writing, you know, a crazy video game story. It's been pretty good. And then last week I had somebody follow me on Twitter, And I saw that he was one of the head writers for Blizzard Entertainment. Of course, they do World of Warcraft and StarCraft and all that stuff. And so I just messaged him. I said, hey, like, how did you get that job? I'm really jealous. And long story short, he got in touch with me and asked to see my writing resume. And I'm doing some work for them for basically writing short stories for them.
Nice.
And yeah, it's a really great opportunity. And, you know, I mean, I can't talk too much about what I'm doing at this point, cause I'm still, you know, getting the contract signed and everything like that, but that's really exciting. And, so all this paid work kind of seems to be coming up, and, but I'm still trying to manage my comics. And I kind of came up into a jam, when I realized I think it was actually Jim Valentino emailed me. And said, hey, the solicitation for Debris is due tomorrow. Can you guys send that in? I hadn't even written a script at that point yet. And when you solicit your first issue, you have to have 4 pages of completed art. So oh, yeah. I said to Jim, or I emailed Riley, and all the email, because Riley was attached on that first email. And all it said in my email was "fuck." So we got on the Skype, and I said, "Okay, look, I'll get this script written. Like, you know, what's our turnaround time? We had to get our colorist on board, and so we literally got the solicitation. I got that written. I wrote the script for what Riley needed to draw, and we did it Marvel style, baby. We basically talked on Skype about what was going to happen in the scene. Riley started drawing right when we got off the call, and then I started writing it after. So we planned the scene, and then I kind of filled in the pieces afterwards. So
that's
and
cool.
Then
that could work, man.
Yeah, and it worked. Like, it had to work. I mean, we really had no choice. And so it actually worked out fairly well. You know, I think if it had been a situation where it was like somebody that I hadn't worked with before, it would have been a total catastrophe. But you know, Riley and I, we understand each other very well. So it was like, we talked about it. Okay, these are the 4 pages. This is what we're going to do. This is what needs to happen thematically. Okay, so he did all that, and then I came in after and I filled in, you know, basically the dialogue and stuff like that. So it worked out really good. The pages are gorgeous. Luckily, we had Owen Gienny, who's he's the illustrator on Evangeline. He's coloring Debris for us, and it's gorgeous, gorgeous work. It's Riley, but his stuff is really cleaned up, and then these really bright, vibrant, almost kind of like non-player style colors over top of it. It's people aren't even going to be able to recognize it. It's so different. But anyway, so I've been caught on this a few times where, like, I think I have a month to, you know, a month before I solicit, and then I get this email and I'm like, what am I thinking? Like, where is my head? You know, I got to write this shit down, and then I never do. So, but it's the progress has been great, you know, like, I've been writing Debris. I'm still managing with, you know, Peter Panzerfaust, which has been going extremely well. We're really happy with that. And, it's just, I'm still really learning how to manage. I know I keep talking about that, but it's really coming down to, you know, balancing my paid work and my traveling now as well on top of my personal comic project. So, I guess on that note, it looks pretty official that I'm going to be moving. My girlfriend and I are going to probably be setting sails to Vancouver, Canada. So I have a job offer out there. The company that I've been doing kind of freelancing for, Day 21 Studios, they want to bring me in house and work in the office there. So it's a great opportunity. I am tired of this cold. The cold in this province can kiss my ass. I'm out. So we're looking at moving out of here in the summer. And so it's going to change the game once again. You know, I'm going to be taking an office job, but it's creative. So, I guess.
So does that mean you're going to be like working, sitting around on fitness balls and playing ping pong? Or?
No, I don't. I hope not. It's weird. You know, I think about it. It's like right now my day consists of I wake up when my girlfriend gets up to go to work. I reach over and I put my computer on my lap in bed and I stay there all day. That's my office right now. Yeah. Sometimes I venture to put on pants. sometimes I don't. You know, I joked on Twitter the other day that my imagined creativity would be would basically be me sitting in my underpants in bed eating grilled cheese, because that's the reality.
See, I would say that you saying that is disturbing. What disturbed me was the Twitterverse going, "Ooh, I want to see that."
I said I wanted to frame it above my desk as inspiration.
Yeah.
I thought you said it was on your roof next to your mirror. No, wrong tweet. Sorry.
Anyway, so yeah, lots of changes coming up for me in this year, and then of course we talked about a few things before the show. There's lots of events happening around my projects, and so it's all happening very quickly, and it's just learning to adapt my lifestyle so I can still have my life outside of my work, I guess. So it's the constant battle, but that's where I'm at. How about you, Jeremy?
I have two pitches that are going to be ready for Emerald City that, I got the prints on Friday. I haven't seen them actually, cause I don't work Fridays and Saturdays. So the prints were just waiting at work for me. The printer, RA Comics Direct, sent me the proofs. I approved them, and literally they got to my job where I had them sent to in 2 days, which was amazing.
That's nice.
Yeah. So I haven't actually seen them yet, but from the proofs, I'm sure they're fine. So I submitted them around just through email, and I plan to do that just so when I see certain people at Emerald City, it's going to be more of a follow up rather than a cold pitch. So that's going well. That feels good to have those done because I've been stressing over those for quite a while now. But other than that, I'm working on a project with Ariel Zucker Brull, who's the artist on the Hack/ Annual. Or was the artist. So him and I are collaborating. Found out he lives in New York, and we've actually had a mutual friend for a while now, but tracked him down because he had some free time in his schedule, so we're working on something together. I guess something really early, which is kind of a trial run. W. Scott Forbes pitched me something that he's been trying to work on, but he just hasn't had time, but he wants someone to write it. So I've been wanting to work with him for a while, so I said, just send me the material and I'll pitch you something as an audition. And he's like, oh, totally. So that was really exciting. So he sent me the files today. I'm going to look those over after we get done here and hopefully wrap something up tonight to send to him, because I would love to work with him on like a mini series or whatever. I also linked up with another artist, Paul Tucker, who started following me on Twitter. He's another Canadian artist who's awesome. He's going to work on this Lineage pitch of mine, which is basically the Incredibles meets Watchmen.
That's a good story.
Yeah. And it's been good because it's 100% collaborative. So he's been throwing me ideas and he's on Gmail. So we G chat all the time and we have a Dropbox. So he's just filling it with just random notes and ideas he has. And, we want to go with we want to have a touchstone with Breaking Bad, this kind of idea where, the idea of someone doing good, but really it's not exactly good things. And the protagonist eventually becomes the antagonist kind of thing. So that's kind of a theme we want to play with, which should be really fun. But I just can't do anything until after Emerald City because, I don't know. I'm just stuck in this waiting game. I feel like I'm back to where I find myself when I'm done with some pitches. And there's some people on Twitter that were like, you need to just finish them and just finish an issue. And I don't know if I could, like, with Cobble Hill, I think with the art team I have assembled, I know Selena would want to continue. She wants to continue working on it. So I could maybe do that, which I actually might do. But I don't know. I don't know if I'm ready to commit to that. And then I don't know where to go from there. Like, with a full issue of something, I don't know. But
I mean, there's the crowdsourced fundraising, but I don't know. I'm interested to see that people seem to think that's a well you should only tap once.
Yeah.
Which I don't agree with, to be honest. I mean,
really?
I see it as much as a pre-ordering system as much as I do anything else. I mean, if your pre-order for a single issue is $50, I'm not pre-ordering your shit. But if you've got a reasonable price on there, then yeah, I just think it's a different business model. And I mean, some people hail it as the next generation, and some people are sort of talking about the arse end falling out of it soon. But realistically, like if Ed Brisson, who just had success with the Murder Book 3, got there, I don't expect him to have made enough money to cover the print run for Murder Book 4. I would be more than fine if he put it up there. I would have the opportunity to know that I can order it. He had decent prices.
Yeah, but I think the difference is that I think with something like Kickstarter or Indiegogo is that if you have an established audience, even if it's a small one, it tends to work better than just doing something as like the initial way to bring eyes onto a project. Like, I just think about it, like, I don't really have much of an audience. So if I pitch like something that I want to put together, like, it's me just asking my friends, like, and I don't feel really comfortable with that. Like, I don't know. I'd rather put the time in because I'm more comfortable getting a pitch together and talking to an editor about it and networking that way, which is like, you know, I feel more comfortable doing that because I've done it for 5 years. So, you know, putting it online and just hoping for the best is something I'm not really ready, but I guess.
The alternative is if you shop it around editors and it doesn't get picked up. I mean, if you committed to that story, do you want to see it made or not?
I don't know. I just want to keep making stories. So it's like, I don't know. It's one of those things I think by the end of this year, I'm going to have to really sit down and think about, because I'm within this 5-year goal. This is my 5th year to get picked up by a major publisher. And if I don't, I mean, it's not that I'm going to stop writing, but yeah, you know, I might have to rethink about
reevaluate how you're going about it. Yeah. And I mean, they call it Kickstarter because it's meant to kickstart your career. It's not meant to keep it afloat. Like, you're supposed to, I guess, find your own legs and get out there. But
that's a good point.
I don't know.
What do you guys think of, wasn't it Palmiotti's Queen Crab? Didn't he fund that on Kickstarter?
Yeah.
What do you think about creators like, especially Palmiotti, who's, you know, he's been doing this a while. He's already established in the industry. How do you guys feel about people like that getting it funded and then getting it published through a major publisher? Like, do you feel that that's weird?
Yeah, I don't know. It is weird because it's like, why wouldn't the publisher just want to print it?
Yeah, you know, like, because that was something that we, Riley and I talked about for Green Wake, and then Riley kind of brought up, he's like, yeah, it's a bit weird to get people to pay for it, and then we would, like, go through Image and then get paid for it. Seems like a weird thing.
Huh.
I don't know. Anyway, I just thought I'd bring that.
It's an interesting discussion. I don't think anyone out there's got the answers. I mean, ultimately, if I see Curtis Weeb on there pimping his 5th series and I'm like, screw that dick, he's got a job, well, I just won't pledge to it. Like, if you want it, you want it. Yeah. If you don't, you don't. That's the way I would say it. Do I think Jimmy Palmiotti, who's very well established in the scene, doing it that route is different? Possibly, but I also see Kickstarter as a great way to disseminate your voice. I mean, he's probably got a stack of Twitter followers and he's certainly got a really well-run website. But I go to Kickstarter and I surf through the comics just to see what's there. So maybe I would find something that I wouldn't have come across another way. It's sort of like another promotional avenue. And as long as you're not just saying, hey, I want you to pledge $20 for a thank you, I cannot stand seeing that. I don't want if I want to just help you, I'll just give you some money. Don't put it as a pledge listing. Put something either that I can get. I see it as much as I want to help these people, I also wouldn't mind something in return. And when we ran Beginnings, one of the first things that came up in the editorial meeting, I said, we're not offering a thank you pledge because it's worthless. Yeah. Every time I see that on a pledge drive, I just sort of go, I don't really care. You've just wasted you can only have like 10 or 11 pledges. You've just wasted one slot with something I don't really care about. Like, I don't want that. I want your product or I want to help. You shouldn't be helping to get a thank you. And who cares in the end anyway? I don't know. I passionately love Kickstarter and Indiegogo, and but I still just don't. I'm interested to see public response to how people use it. And, yeah. I mean, it certainly yields a lot of success. And the ones that it doesn't, you can see why, because it got priced out of the ass. Like, people aren't going to pay $20 for a single issue. It's just unrealistic. And people need to be a bit more forthcoming and just going, we offered the Beginnings anthology, which is selling for $30 now, for $20 postage included on our Indiegogo. We were going the opposite way and giving people a discounted deal. That's smart. And that's why we raised over like 200%. Like, you've got to treat it like a business, not as some hat in your hand pledge drive, because you don't have cancer. You are not a support cause. You're somebody that's either asking people to get behind you or to get behind your product.
Right.
I don't know. That's my rant for today.
Well, we should probably move on anyway. Unless, Jeremy, do you have anything else you wanted to add to that? Or
No. Yeah, it's an interesting, because I don't think about Kickstarter that much, but what you've just said is very insightful. But okay, so with the Gorillum section, we're taking a question from one of our listeners. Phil Buthorn on Facebook asked, How much does it usually cost when putting together a pitch, and how do you put together a budget for it? So I guess I will chime in because I just finished two pitches. You need to look for a printer, obviously. I've gone through a couple. I've looked up a couple. The first one I ever used was Kablam, which was a terrible experience because you have questions or they send you the PDF proof and the pages are in the wrong order and you send a message and they don't come back to you for 2 days. And then I found out they stopped providing PDF proofs. Like, you have to order one copy. They will mail it to you and then you can order the printer. And it takes 4 to 6 weeks for a copy. So I was like, this is ridiculous. So I don't know how I found out about RA Comics Direct. They were just on Twitter. I think they followed me. And the guy, Jim Anderson over there, is just very attentive and he's passionate about it and he loves what he does. And he sends you a PDF proof that day. And as soon as you approve it, he can get it to you in a myriad of ways. And, you know, so for RA Comics, they have a minimum of 25 copies per print. So for a, say, a 12-page or 16-page pitch, and it's full color, it was $75 total for each print run, which wasn't too bad. I mean, it wasn't exactly – I mean, it was kind of a strain on my budget, but because I was paying artists and whatnot. But it was definitely worth it because I got it in 2 days. Like, I could have waited till this week, this coming week, to have the book sent out, and I still would have got them in time. So,
yeah.
But, I mean, as far as that you know, I read Phil's question earlier, and it was also about, like, artists and stuff like that. And it's just, like, you don't really need – I mean, you hopefully can find someone who's willing to do back-end pay, obviously, and shared IP. Because if you're paying an artist, then, you know, you might skimp on the print, and that's going to hurt you in the end. So,
With budgeting for it, Jeremy, did you sort of set aside all the costs beforehand to make sure that you had the money, and has it impacted –
Absolutely, because I mentioned that to Jim. I said, you know, I'm reviewing my budget. Budget's gonna be kind of tight. Paying both of these runs, like, can I lower the print run to like 15 or 20? And he says, you know, honestly, the cost of doing 15 is the same cost as doing 25. So we do a minimum of 25 for a reason. And he's like, maybe you could start like a Kickstarter, but that's probably too late. But I'd already budgeted. I just was trying to save some money for when I go to Seattle. But that I had to do that ahead in advance because, you know, I wouldn't have been able to do it any other way.
That's not true. I mean, Kurt, from what I can understand, when you put a pitch together, you have to factor in the costs of internet and downloading Skype and then basically just selling whatever you say. Isn't that how it works now?
That's exactly right. That's how I roll now.
Do you budget for that? Is it hard?
It's all about budgeting my time, my friend, which is, it's a premium now. Just, No, you know, like, It's when Scott and I put our pitch together for Intrepids, you know, I don't know what the actual cost was, but I don't remember, but it was, you know, between me and him, we actually split the cost. And, you know, it was part of, you know, when we were doing the actual physical copies, like, you know, we've talked about before on the show, we weren't doing it just like to have on hand. We did it in conjunction with making a trip to send it around. So you not only have to be aware of, like, budgeting, putting the pitch together, but it really is a necessity that you take that pitch and you bring it to editors at a convention. So, you know, it's more than just the actual pitch itself. It's also, it should be combined with making a trip to, like, a local convention, if you can do it, where there's going to be editors. Cause you know, for us to go to all that effort, you know, it would probably be a waste of time to just mail it in. It might, you know, might still catch people's eyes compared to the rest of the slush pile, but you're still dealing with the slush pile at that point. So, you know, you have to also keep that in mind.
For sure.
And I'm wondering how much Phil is thinking about us paying other people that are helping put the pitch together, like colorists, letterers, and artists.
Yeah.
And I know we've spoken pretty passionately about that before, and I don't know, every now and then I'll throw it up on Twitter just because it's interesting to see people's views on, especially paying artists up front. And I know we've spoken here about the fact that putting together creator-owned comics, it's got to be shared IP. Like,
yeah,
it's amazing to see how many people, and not always just artists, that view that differently and sort of say, well, the artists are putting in the hardest work and they're putting in the most time and they can't work for free. And while I do agree they put in more time, but I've only ever once paid for pages, and while that didn't get picked up, it was with Justin Greenwood, and we've remained mates. So I guess, you know, it was a good way to pay for friendship. But
well, yeah,
it wasn't sort of going anywhere further. And every other artist I've worked with has been we're doing everything on spec.
Yeah, I mean, I've done the same thing. I paid an artist, and that crashed and burned horribly. And what I tell people that are willing to work for back end pay is, well, first of all, I make sure they want to draw something that I've written. Like, I ask them, what do you want to draw, and I write something around that. But also I tell them, this is what I'm willing to do. I'm willing to go to the conventions. I'm willing to do all the press for it. I'm willing to get the word out about it. I'm willing to print it. I'm willing, because that's my end. And that's also a lot of heavy lifting. Sure, it's not me sitting at a drawing table for, you know, 10 hours a day, but, you know, that's stuff that I know a lot of artists can't afford to go out to, and someone needs to represent. I mean, like Curtis said, you need to go to the cons. It's important. Like, if I didn't go to the con for Image Expo, even though I had nothing to pitch, I would not have met Tim Daniel, and Tim Daniel would not have designed the logo and pitch for Cobble Hill, which makes it look professional, because it is. He's a professional. So, yeah.
Sorry, it makes it sound a little bit like mooches, but I don't know. I've never heard of a writer getting paid beforehand. And
No. When you know, for us, we've been doing this a while. So it's like, if you build up enough work, you can show a prospective artist that you've produced work, and that you know, you do follow through with your commitments, and that at some point you have to be confident in what you've done. You have to be confident that I'm a writer. Hell yeah, I'm a writer. Just like an artist is saying, hell yeah, I'm an artist. And you just have to go in together with the same understanding that, you know, you're building something together. I mean, we all know that Riley took, you know, back in pay and shared IP for Cowboy Ninja Viking, and that's going into production as a film. So yeah. It's like, that's, I mean, granted, that's a hyper example, because that doesn't always happen, but that's,
yeah,
that's the advantage. But yeah.
Go ahead, Ryan.
So I was just going to say, when I put together my pitches, there's just not a lot to budget at the moment, because you call in favors and you build connections, and I mean, that's probably the hardest thing to do, is to find a colorist that'll work for free, or to find a letterer that'll work for free. And
sure,
it's few and far between. But the big thing, hopefully, is just the printing costs, and then getting to the cons and getting it into editors' hands, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's move on to the process then. We're going to be talking about managing scripts today. So basically, what, if any, elements of your script are the most important for an artist to keep intact, or do you give them free rein of it after final revisions are complete? It's kind of funny, because what I talked about earlier, what happened with Debris. You know, it really depends for me on, like, who I'm working with, I guess, and how much I trust them to deliver what I'm thematically going for. I've very rarely had to go back and say, this needs to be changed. You know, it's something that's very rarely where I'm like, no, you need to stay exactly to the script here. I mean, you can see it in Green Lake. It happened all the time. Riley wouldn't draw what I told him to draw. You know, he would just do what he wanted a lot of the time. But, you know, it worked, because he thematically knew what the tone of the scene was. And I'm, you know, I have to trust him to, he's building the flow of the page. And so if he feels like all of a sudden, you know, camera angle that I've asked for, or, you know, like characters in that particular panel, if he can do something a little bit more dramatic with it, a little bit more, you know, that fits the tone better, then I'm going to trust him to do it. I guess I have learned a lot in letting artists really feel the story alongside with what I'm trying to do. There's very rarely, I think the only time I ever got Riley to make a change that was, you know, really obvious was, I think it was in issue 2 or 3 when they were in a sex club, and, there's dudes pulling out this guy's intestines and eating them. I was like, no, that's too much. too far. Sorry. and then that was it. And I don't know. How about you guys? Like, how do you feel about this?
I find it's really hard with writing a script, because I'm not an artist. And so to lay over this, like, you must draw this, when I can't do it, I couldn't even thumbnail it for them. But to be so specific is hard. And the big thing that I feel is, if there's something that I need to control the flow of time, or it needs to beat in a certain way on the page, or I very specifically want an angle because it's going to lead to this reveal or something, then yeah, I'll put it in the script. But a lot of the times I've gotten pages back from artists and things are a bit different. And my instinct is to be like, oh, we'll see about this. I'll tell them I wanted it on the left side. And then I look at it and go, no, they've made a really good choice. it's their 50% of the creation. They're putting their artistic bent on it. And if it's not ruining what's happening, it's just not necessarily my initial vision. But if it's not ruining anything, I'm kind of happy to leave it. I think that they should have a fair bit of free reign. But I guess it comes into how prescriptive are you in your scripts? How much detail do you provide?
Right. I just the reason I posed this question in the guide for today's show is because I know that there are writers that this idea of their vision needs to be intact and it has to look a certain way kind of borders on the whole thing of, do I copyright my script? You know, that nervousness, and you have to trust your artist. Like I've said this before, if you're paying your artist, I believe they have to draw what you say. Like if you want something a certain way, they're getting paid a page rate and they have zero input. With shared IP and this co-collaboration, Curtis is right. I think that you need to trust your artist. You need to get to know them. I think the most important thing other than just working is to call them or set up some kind of chat where you can just talk to them. And don't talk about comics, whatever, but get to know them. Get to know them as a person because it makes it that much more fun. And you can trust them if you get into a pinch with needing pages at a certain time or deadlines or whatever, that you know you can fully trust them. And what I've realized with putting books together and what I've written is that I trust my artists. And also, if it's going smoothly at the beginning, like when you're assembling a pitch and there's no deadlines really, and there's no pressure of an editor or whatever, it's going to probably be a lot of fun to work on if it gets greenlit, because you know you can count on that team. And they've been productive, they've been on time. But I realize that there are projects I look back in the past and they were a headache and a nightmare and artists arguing with each other. And I'm glad they didn't go through, because God, if they did, I'd be screwed. And that's my reputation. And that's my integrity of my work can be compromised if not everyone's working together. And it's, you know, that's one of those things where I trust them. I tell them, look, I want your input. All I want is for you to build a house where you put the rooms, where you put the stairs. I don't care. As long as I walk in and I see that it's a house, I'm fine. Like, I just need pacing and the themes to be intact, and that's it. However you want to draw them is up to you. So,
yeah, I mean, I've definitely, you know, with sorry, are you going to ask something, Ryan?
Yeah, I was going to say, Kurt, have you ever had like an issue with this before, where something just hasn't sort of come across?
Yeah.
You don't have to name names, but
no, it's, you know, this was. I thought at the time that it was an art issue, but it was actually a script issue. I'm willing to go on record of admitting to it. So, issue one, Peter Panzerfaust, the number one complaint was the ending. And it felt at the time that when I wrote it, it was like it was an obvious cliffhanger, but a lot of people just did not know what was happening. And so Tyler had originally illustrated it in a certain way. I think it was the same image, but it was pushed in. It was too close. And I felt, no, it doesn't read right because we're not getting a sense of space. You know, it's not it's the art that's holding up this page. So I got Tyler to redo it, and then he pulled it back and we got a bit more reference. And then I felt, you know, I was like, okay, yeah, this makes more sense now. And then universally, pretty much like, you know, even with all the really good reviews we got, pretty much everyone's like, I really love this book, but I do not get the ending. What is going on? And everybody would say, oh, there felt like there should be two more pages, and they were right. And it was a total failed cliffhanger. I was talking to Nick Spencer at Image Expo, and he's like, Curtis, great book. Just one thing, you failed on that ending. Nice. I just nodded. I was like, I know. So, it wasn't a well-executed ending. But as far as like, I haven't really had major issues with like, scenes that were done and they didn't work out. I feel like I've been really lucky. And oftentimes I'm really actually surprised at how well they turn out. And none other than like Alessio Santos is doing Grim Reaper. There's been so many times in the script where I just felt like this is a good scene. You know, it's not great, but it's a good scene. It's got a bit of humor or whatever. And then he comes back with the art and I'm laughing, and he brings that extra added, you know, the characters and the expressions. And it's just sometimes pays to let them really have fun with the camera and fun with the expression and make it their story as well. And I've really never encountered a really, a frustrating experience where what I was going for was completely taken the wrong way. It's always been just minor things. Like in issue three, Peter Panzerfaust, Tyler put on German symbols onto a plane that wasn't German. And the scene would have been so confusing. I said, no, like we can't have that on there. And so just little things like that, that are easy fixes.
Yeah.
How prescriptive are you with your scripts? I know with my scripts, I put in a fair bit of detail of sort of what I want to see and what I want to be there. But then when I liaise with the artist, I say, they're guides. If you want to run, if you want to get your J.H. Williams III on, go for it. If you want to stick to script and just sort of beat it out that way, that's absolutely fine. I let them know that it will sound very absolute and the modality is high in those scripts, but it is still a collaboration.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's better to have it in place than not, right? Like, so that if they want to build that feeling, it's only going to help them. And then that allows them to go off that really intense description because it's going to bring visuals to their minds the better described it is, or, you know, the more love that you put into it yourself, they're going to get a lot more visuals out of it. It really depends, too, for me. Like, when I'm writing my scripts, a lot of, like, I guess I would call, like, filler panels where it's just, like, you just need to get some dialogue across or like a facial reaction. I generally would just say, you know, a shot of Bob and Bob is feeling like really embarrassed or really nervous and just give something brief and the emotion he's feeling plus the dialogue. And that usually works out fairly well for the artist because, you know, they're used to bringing out emotion on the page. Unless it's like a really important scene that I feel generally the first panel of, you know, page one, panel one. That one is usually like a half a page for me for every issue of just like set the scene. I go into it as describe it as best I can describe it. I'm putting in emotions. I'm putting in mood, all of that stuff to establish that scene. And then from there, it's pretty sparse. And then the next time I change the scene or I change the mood, then you get about another paragraph or, you know, whatever, a lot more descriptive.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. I don't think it can be a real balance.
I don't get super descriptive. I mean, I describe it's very terse, I guess. It's just to the point. And like before earlier scripts, I would just describe so much crap that had nothing to do with anything. And then, you know, I'd even forget that I wrote some of it. So it's like, yeah, just be very open. And I realize what I try not to do is write camera angles because only if it's absolutely necessary, because I find when I've reread stuff, it's just way too much. It seems like micromanaging.
Yeah.
It's no fun for the artist. And so I try not to do that, to have camera angles, just like maybe establishing shots and stuff like that. But everything else is just pretty open.
That's cool. There's some good tips for some people. I like it when we delve into scripts. That script talk is always good. Let's look at the time. We'll move into the round table. And this one, it should sort of thematically bring everything home. I think at the top of this page, Jeremy had put pitch season in full swing, and it is indeed the season of the pitch. And so we just want to look at the art of the pitch with what are things to be mindful of when pitching via online submissions and in person at a convention. One of the things that instantly sprang to mind with this topic was actually like the end process, and that's follow-up. I always find with follow-up, there's got to be a fine line between being a pest and putting them off and then waiting too long and they go, oh, I forgot about that one. What do you lads think about like the follow-up of the pitch? What's the art there?
Oh yeah, it's super important. And, you know, it's funny cause you're right. Cause you always feel like you're being a nuisance. You feel like you're like irritating them, but I don't think that's an issue. I think a lot of the times, you know, a lot of these editors are so up to their eyeballs in work that they literally do forget. You send them an email, hey, just checking in. And they're like, oh yeah, I forgot about that pitch. And then, you know, an hour later, they get something slapped on their desk. Hey, this needs to be worked on. And they completely forget about it. Even if they like that, even if they are really excited about the pitch, that's just like a tenth of their job, you know? Yeah. So I've definitely had this experience. I've been in contact with Dark Horse about something. And I felt the same way. I'm like, I don't want to irritate them. I don't want to be like, hey, remember I sent you that pitch like a month ago? What's going on with that? And, you know, it's like, you know, I put in the work and the artist put in the work. We were both really passionate about it. And so I've just every few weeks, I just send an email just saying, hey, you know, what's the progress on this? You know, can I send you any more material? Do you want to talk about anything? I'll make myself available. And literally every time he's been like, oh yeah. He's like, I talked with people about it. We're at this stage right now. And, you know, then nothing happens after that. And then I'm like, it's like, you know, obviously they're not interested and I should stop bothering. But it's like, you know what? I did the work. I'm going to keep following up until I get a solid answer. And I've been doing that. And literally the last time I got the email back from the editor, he's like, you know what? He's like, I have sent it to the higher up editors because he's not, you know, one who makes the final decision. He's like, I'm going to go talk to everybody, put it on their minds again. And, you know, I'll see if I can get an answer for you. And, you know, that's all I can ask. And I don't think that's annoying for him. He clearly liked the pitch enough to send it along. So, I think follow-up is a massive part of it. And don't be afraid. Like, what's the worst that they're going to do is say, you know what, you are not getting published because you've emailed me too many times. Well, who's that happened to? I've never heard that story, you know?
I mean, Kurt and I know the story with Enrique Carrion. So it's like, it's completely different on how you approach follow-up, but it has to be done. Like, just think about how much email they get and multiply by 10 or 100. And yeah, Kurt is right. They're probably just, they've read it and it's in one ear and out the other kind of thing. And
yeah, this one.
I mean, with Stevenson, I submitted two pitches a while ago and I decided to follow up every single week. I was like, you know what? I've done the work. That's just, the same day, every week, I send a brief email and I even attached the pitches again, every email, until I think it was like maybe 2 months later, he actually emailed me back with a bunch of notes. And he was just like, oh, so sorry, I've been really busy, but, you know, I did have a chance to look at it, and he went into it, and it's just like, oh, that's awesome. Like, you just, I mean, but be, like, brief and to the point, not like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's why I love Gmail, because it keeps it all in one thread, and you can see all the email back and forth, and the last one, it shows you, sent 4 days ago. I love that shit, because then I just get on there and go, because I can never remember. Sometimes I'm like, oh, man, this is taking forever, and then I'll look in, and it's been 3 days. I'm like, oh. Well, okay. Right, so I haven't been waiting that long. Calm down. But I'll look in there and say, okay, it's been 4 or 5 days. And I'll always send an email and just sort of say, hey, just checking in and making sure I bump up to the top of your inbox. Thanks for that. And I'll speak to you soon. Like, just keep it really jovial. I mean, I would assume the moment you send a follow-up being like, why haven't you gotten back to me? I demand a response. Yeah, that's going to cost you the job. But yeah, if you're nice, and I mean, this comes back to a rule we've been saying for ages, if you're not a dick about it, you just send an email and be like, hey, just wanted to check in. Hope all is well. Or I'll always sort of send it on. Sometimes I'll send it on a Friday and say, oh, I hope it gives you some weekend reading, and then follow up on the Monday. Oh, okay, I hope you can get to it this week. And don't follow up every day, but I try to at least send a follow up once a week.
Yeah.
And it does. It pushes it up the inbox and they go, oh, yeah, I've been meaning to get back to you. And that's the same with chasing up collaborators as well. If those colored pages haven't come in, you just send a friendly response and they go, oh, yeah, just want to touch base with you and they'll get back to you. So yeah, it just needs to be simple, I think.
And as far as pitches go, there is an importance on going to a convention, because it's so much easier for you to go and make FaceTime with an editor. And if you happen to leave something that they want to talk about or even show around to someone, at least they remember who you are. So they may not remember the name immediately, but just getting yourself on their radar is so important. Like, I went to WonderCon last year, met Charlie Chu very briefly through a friend of mine, Bram Revell, and then like almost a year later, or maybe 8 or 9 months later, I see Charlie at New York Comic Con, and he doesn't even hesitate. He immediately says, hey, Jeremy, how's it going? And I mean, it's really important to do that, to just get out there, because it's, you know, if you don't have that option, like, you know, Ryan is so far, far, far away. You know, these are tricks of the trade to use with as far as emailing and etiquette, but definitely try to go to a convention if you can.
One day, man. One day. It'll be me. I almost promise. Damn it.
Yeah.
Anything else about pitches you want to get into, boys?
I don't know. I think, you know, it's they keep saying, you know, 2012, year of the creator, like we said earlier, and this is, it's a good time to really invest in your career. And you know, there's great opportunities. There's a lot of conventions where everyone, even you know, some of the publishers that were closing their doors a lot before, like, you know, they're licensing more, or they're just like, oh, we're not sure. I think there's a real passion for new stories, and I think the doors are a little bit more open than they were even last year. And that's just kind of the feeling that I get, that there's a new hunger for new talent and new books. You know, if you are thinking about investing and getting pitches together, and you're worried about, can I afford it? Well, really weigh it, because, it could make the difference. And I really think I'd encourage anyone out there to really invest this year, get your pitches together, get all your ducks in a row, and get to a convention or put together your best damn pitch you can put together and start emailing it and following up with those emails. And I think it's a ripe opportunity this year. So that's my thoughts.
Yeah, I'd say don't go sending in all those superhero ideas. I think this is the year where people are wanting to branch out and think about that in genre and tone and everything else as well. Don't be worried about it. Doesn't need to look like a Marvel or DC book at the moment. You can be a little bit – I mean, you look at a lot of your work, Kurt. The artists are really, really individual.
Yeah, they're good style. Yeah, it's much more independent. It's not – they don't look like your big two, that's for sure.
And that's a good thing, man. I mean, you look at the art for Grim Leaper coming up. Stuff's gorgeous.
Yeah, it's very unconventional, and it's very unique. And I like that. My stuff probably isn't the most commercial, but whatever. I enjoy writing it, and I love seeing it come to life. And I pick artists that are going to be capable of really delivering on, either the bizarre element or the fun aspect. And I don't regret anybody that I've worked with. That's for sure. They've all brought such a great, unique, personal twist on something that, is just an idea in my head until they put their hands to it. So
nice. Boys, you ready to wrap it up here?
Yeah, let's do it.
Excellent. Obviously, Image Addiction Podcast that hosts us on their network, doing a fantastic job. I've really been enjoying listening to their show. Actually, I don't know if you guys listen a lot, but man, they give us some props on there every time. they're loving what we're doing for them, which is really cool. So hopefully everybody listening has got a bit of insight. And I just want to talk about the fact that if you want to be a writer, then write. And it's something that everybody sort of hears, and I don't know if it always really means something. There's not a lot of math attached to it. It's not like, when do we write and how much do we write or why. Recently I came up with this artist ratio, which artist meaning creative person, not like a pencil, an inking team. And my concept of this ratio is that, and maybe it only works for me, I don't know, is that if you want to be taken seriously as a creator, you have to spend more time creating that entertainment than absorbing entertainment, even if it's just like 51-49%. That ratio only really counts for spare time, though, so like, don't worry about work or family commitments or anything like that. Now, I'm not saying don't chill out in front of the TV. Everybody needs a break. I mean, if you watch 4 hours of TV and you write for 1 hour a night, maybe you should expect a 20% chance of success in the long run. I mean, another axiom it's talked about is that success is predominantly perspiration, and that doesn't mean being some fat bastard on the couch who's laboring through his wheezing breath because of chisel clogged arteries. It means that you have to work your ass off. You have to be more expressive than receptive. At least that's always my rule. People generally seem to think I do a lot, so I don't know. Maybe what I do is a load of crap. Maybe for a few years it probably was, but that hard work will pay off. And I can admit I get a little gung-ho at times, and my artist ratio is probably about 85-15. And that's why I'm behind on nearly every TV show out there, but I am usually caught up on my work. See how that goes? I've even worked in that the TV I watch is like a study hour to deconstruct story and structure and become inspired. Hell, I really now only listen to podcasts with a focus and information. I can't just have chatter. It's got to be stuff like this where there's actual process and thought and information coming through. So go out there and think about, don't spend all your time just receiving that entertainment. You need to be proactive in creating your entertainment. Now, as far as us here at The Process, guys, all three of us are in the majority of creating, I'm certain of it. And right now, we're creating for you. And dear constant listener, don't worry. This is your research. You're sweet. We're just the foreplay for your own creation. So now that we've whet your appetite, go out there deep into the listless, inky night and create.